This podcast is for healthcare professionals only and is supported by an independent educational grant from AstraZeneca.
Welcome back to the Oncology Brothers podcast. I'm Rahul Gosain, here with my brother and co-host Rohit Gosain. Today, we're kicking off a four-part series on hepatocellular carcinoma, HCC. We'll start off with first-line treatment options, then we'll switch gears to focus on second-line treatment options. Thereafter, the last two discussions will touch on the evolving space of intermediate HCC. Coming back to this, our first session, let's talk about IO and IO combinations in advanced unresectable HCC. To cover this, we're joined by Dr. Rachna Shroff, a medical oncologist and the chief of hematology and oncology at the University of Arizona Cancer Center. Rachna, welcome.
Thank you both so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Diving into our topic, which is first-line treatment options for hepatocellular carcinoma, we have seen few options evolve through the course here. Before committing to any of our patients with these treatments, it is important to keep medical comorbidities in mind, along with liver function. If you don't mind touching on the frontline treatment options, where this is rather evolved, and the most likely option that we have been utilizing is all immunotherapy-based now.
Absolutely. It's such an exciting and different landscape for treating hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer. We've really moved into the immunotherapy space, as you suggested, and it is a really complex disease because the underlying liver cirrhosis really plays into how we approach these patients and how they do in terms of overall prognosis. But in terms of newly diagnosed advanced hepatocellular carcinoma, we really have immunotherapy as the mainstay. And that really was first brought about with the IMbrave 150 data. So this was the study that looked at atezolizumab and bevacizumab, a monoclonal antibody against VEGF, that's bevacizumab, with a checkpoint inhibitor, and that is the atezolizumab. And that was compared to what was our standard of care at the time, which is sorafenib. And, you know, this study initially came out in 2020, but then there was subsequent additional longer-term follow-up and data that was then published. And with the updated analysis, which was a median follow-up of about a year and a half, like 15 and a half months, the atezolizumab and bevacizumab arm did continue to statistically significantly improve overall survival. So the median overall survival in this arm was 19.2 months compared to sorafenib, which was 13.4 months. Similarly, we saw an improvement in progression-free survival as well from 4.3 months to 6.9 months. And an objective response rate of 30% with the atezo-bev arm compared to about 11% with sorafenib. So just all the key efficacy endpoints with longer-term follow-up that was proof of principle that in patients with preserved liver function, so all of these studies are Child-Pugh A cirrhosis patients, meaning early-stage cirrhosis, that there is an immunotherapy option with atezolizumab and bevacizumab. But like you mentioned, we also have additional options now, and that's what's really making this interesting, a little bit more complicated, but somewhat exciting. And so the second option that really came about was based on the Himalaya study. So the Himalaya study was a large global study as well that looked at a combination dual immunotherapy approach. And that was what's historically called the STRIDE regimen, but basically is one dose of tremelimumab, which is an anti-CTLA-4, with durvalumab. And it was actually initially a three-arm study. So it was the STRIDE regimen, tremi-durva, versus single agent Durva versus sorafenib. But the study was really looking at overall survival of the STRIDE regimen versus sorafenib. And so when the Himalaya data first came out, it was a positive study. But what was really exciting at ESMO just this year, a couple months ago, we saw the updated five-year overall survival. And again, importantly, with longer-term follow-up, we are seeing continued statistically significantly improved survival with the Durva tremi versus sorafenib. And I just want to remind everyone that the STRIDE regimen is just a single dose of the anti-CTLA-4. So it's tremelimumab times one with Durva, followed by Durva alone. And with this regimen, the median overall survival with STRIDE was 16.4 months versus 13.7 months with sorafenib. But as we typically look for in immunotherapy, what was really impressive about this was that separation of the curves. And so when you look at that Kaplan-Meier with the longer-term five-year OS data, the landmark 60-month overall survival with the STRIDE regimen, 19.6% at the 60-month mark versus 9.4%. So one in five patients still alive. at the 5-year mark with advanced hepatocellular carcinoma, which is just incredible. And so it's just really kind of proof of principle that with newly diagnosed hepatocellular carcinoma patients, we have options, both with a VEGF plus IO approach and then a dual IO approach. And then again, just to kind of complicate but make things equally exciting, is we now have a second option in that dual IO approach, and that's based on the CheckMate 9DW study, which was basically a study that looked at, again, anti-CTLA-4 with a checkpoint inhibitor, nivolumab with ipilimumab, compared to investigator choice. So that here, people were given the option of giving lenvatinib or sorafenib, because by the time this study was designed, lenvatinib was an option for frontline treatment. And so in this study, this was the anti-CTLA-4 was given up to 4 cycles. And so it was a little bit more of an anti-CTLA-4 compared to the Dorva-Tremi approach. And then nivolumab was continued and the primary endpoint was overall survival. And again, at ESMO this year, we kind of saw updated median OS data with a median OS of nivo-ipi at 23.7 months versus 20.6 months in the investigator choice arm of lenvatinib or sorafenib. And again, separation of the curve with a 3-year OS landmark rate at 38% versus 24%. So again, a dual IO approach with a little bit more use of the anti-CTLA-4, kind of more longer-term ipilimumab versus the Dorva-Tremi. So really 3 options. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly where to start with kind of teasing it out. But what's really great is depending on your patient, you can hopefully find an immunotherapy option for them.
Wow, these are exciting times. Rohit, you started off by talking about the landscape shifting. Rachna, you touched on this. Most of the comparator arms were sorafenib or lenvatinib because we did not have any better options. And now here we are, be it because of IMbrave 150 or Himalaya or Stride regimen or CheckMate 9DW, we have a few options. You touched on lenvatinib. Recently, we also saw a combination of pembro with lenvatinib here, which is indeed a negative study. But coming back to our available options, Rachna, how do you decide one over the other? Who's the right patient? What are we looking at in our clinic?
I think it's such a good question. I mean, at the end of the day, there are some small nuances in terms of eligibility between IMbrave versus Himalaya, for instance, in terms of patients who were included with VP4, basically portal vein involvement, which was, tends to be a poorer prognosis, if you will, if there's kind of main portal vein branch involvement. But the honest truth is in clinical practice, I think it really just kind of comes down to potential side effects and or kind of the nuances of how often patients want to come and things like that. So for instance, with the atezo-bev regimen, with the study, everybody had to have an endoscopy because with an anti-VEGF, you worry about the risk of variceal bleeding in patients with known cirrhosis. And so, you know, there are some people who may have varices that are at risk of bleeding. There are some, I hear from a lot of community physicians, sometimes it's just hard to get an endoscopy quickly and to get a look at the varices to see if there's anything of concern. And so in those patients, you know, is Stride an easier option because you're not worried about that bleeding risk. I think there's a lot of people who really appreciate the one-time dose of the Tremi and then, you know, coming back every 4 weeks, which is, you know, unfortunately, with a lot of our hepatocellular carcinoma patients, there's a lot of other psychosocial components that go into their management. And so transportation issues, availability and time off work, I mean, these are real world problems that we deal with. And so I think some of those things are really the ones that play in. Now, CheckMate, you know, we don't have it FDA approved yet, but I would imagine it may or may not be soon, I would think. And there, again, there is the anti-CTLA-4 priming that happens a little bit more regularly. And so it'll be interesting to see what the uptick is. And, you know, we'll talk about safety shortly, but it'll be interesting to kind of see if people, again, from a real world perspective, just prefer that one time anti-CTLA-4 so that they can then just get their one drug every 4 weeks. I think that remains to be seen.
Well, thanks so much for stressing the importance of at least the 3 options, but 2 of them are FDA approved and we'll have to just wait for how nivo-ep turns out. When talking about atezo-bev, as you stressed that, we have stronger data when it comes to portal venous thrombosis. On the contrary to that is Dorva-Tremi with one single dose of Tremi. Longer term, a 5-year survival data is looking promising, as you stated as well. Now, in community, we have to get used to the side effect profile with what you stated with bevacizumab, concerns of bleeding. While with Durva-Tremi, we are aware about the immune-related side effects. Any important clinical pearls that you'd suggest for us to keep in mind, especially with Durva-Tremi and Atizo?
There's what we saw in the trials, and then there's the like actually clinically relevant and kind of issues that we deal with. And I will say, and I don't know what your all experience has been, but with Atezo Bev, you know, the study mandates and thus our chemo orders or our treatment orders basically have us check, for instance, for the urine protein. And, you know, at the end of the day, proteinuria we know is a known side effect from bevacizumab. But a lot of our HCC patients with cirrhosis already have proteinuria, right? Mm-hmm. So how much I put stock in some of those things that were obviously important treatment-related adverse events that were looked at in the study, I think is not as much of a concern as the things related to risk of bleeding, as well as, you know, hypertension that can come from bevacizumab, because any sort of general hypertension in an underlying patient with cirrhosis can become clinically relevant, just depending on what happens with the hepatorenal components to hypertension. But in general, you know, I will say, I mean, we've been using tyrosine kinase inhibitors in these patients, and Lord, do those have their own set of problems. And so I think it's a relatively well-tolerated regimen. Similarly, Durva-Tremi, you know, yes, we obviously are always worried about immune-related adverse events, both with the Atezo from Atezo-Bev, as well as with the dual IO approach like STRIDE. But the honest truth is that there was really no surprising safety signals that came out from the Himalaya study. And the immune-related adverse events were relatively rare and relatively mild and manageable with, you know, steroids or treatment interruption and things like that. And then the updated five-year data just kind of, again, showed that there was really no new safety signals that came out. I think the biggest concern, obviously, with immunotherapy in patients who have hepatocellular carcinoma and, again, have underlying cirrhosis is, you know, a hepatitis, like an autoimmune hepatitis type of picture. And thankfully, at least in the I Am Brave and Himalaya data, it was actually relatively rare. And I will say in clinical practice, when and if I see it, usually it's mild and it's not requiring treatment discontinuation or steroid use or things like that. So, you know, I think that's the beauty of the immunotherapy changes that we've seen with the landscape, because not only are they great in terms of efficacy, but they're overall pretty well tolerated.
And again, the side effects, be it from Atezo-Bev or Durva-Tremi, are not trivial, but in community, at least, we're so used to using these drugs now. Dual checkpoint inhibitors, we use it for lung cancer. Of course, we've used Atezo-Bev now for a period of time. So I do think that there's comfort around these two regimens as well. Rachna, are you swayed one way or the other by the cause of underlying cirrhosis or HCC, viral versus any other etiology? Are you picking one treatment over the other based on that?
And also, yeah, just to add to that, so sorry, before you answer, and does child pew rather dictate your treatment options here as well?
You know, I think those are, again, really good questions. And I think the short answer is I don't right now in terms of etiology and making those decisions. I mean, we know that there's a potential signal that, you know, viral hepatitis may be a little bit more immune responsive. But the honest truth is that none of that has been prospectively validated. It's all been looked at in kind of exploratory analyses that are not powered to answer those questions, right? And so to me, especially in the US, where nowadays our etiology is really more fatty liver, metabolic syndrome leading to more of a NASH picture and our NAFLD and NASH and then subsequent HCC development. And, you know, Hep B has never been a huge problem and hepatitis C is curable now. You know, I think in general, thankfully, in clinical practice, I haven't had to sweat it, I guess, too much. It's really interesting. I mean, I know we're not talking about Camrevo, but the CARES 310 data with camrelizumab and ribociranib, where, you know, majority done in Asia with a very hepatitis B heavy population, you know, I mean, we do not have that FDA approved because there is questions of, you know, how much that viral hepatitis component really drove this. And so I think the jury is still out, but as of right now in the day-to-day, no, I don't use that as a determining factor. In terms of child pew, you know, I think kudos. I believe the Atezo-Bev investigators are doing a child pew up to B7 study looking at Atezo-Bev prospectively. And I believe there's maybe a couple investigator-initiated trials that are also looking at STRIDE and up to a child PUV7. Because again, when you talk about the real world, I mean, most of my patients, we're lucky if we get a child PUA. Most of them are these, these Bs that are teetering, you know? And thankfully, at least in my anecdotal experience and from talking to other investigators around the country, patients tend to do well. I mean, the honest truth is that so much of this is that fine balance between how much the hepatocellular carcinoma is taking over liver parenchyma and contributing to the worsening liver function versus the underlying cirrhosis and that chronic kind of slow burn, if you will, in terms of liver health. And so, you know, I think that is the right trials to be doing, is let's look in the patients that we actually see, as opposed to these, you know, marathon runners, these child PUA type of HCC patients. But as of right now, I case by case make the determination, but child PUV7s with massive ascites look a little bit different than child PUV7s because they have a slightly elevated INR from underlying liver function.
Right. And in the real world, we're actually extrapolating this data day in, day out. A good B7, we treat them as child PUA, and we offer these treatments, even though, again, the initial studies were done on better liver function. But like you mentioned, Rachna, a poor B7, you have to be very cautious on how far you're going to push them. While we're talking about all our treatment options, I'm going to push a little more on the CheckMate 9DW as well. Not FDA approved right now. As you mentioned, more CTLA-4. Is this another me-too combination? When I have tried regimen, at least in my practice, even if this was to get approved, I don't think this will change my practice. Am I missing anything? Can you touch on this a little? If this dual checkpoint inhibitor is another me-too drug, or how do you see that will shift the practice?
It's such a great question. I mean, right now, a lot of people are touting that, again, it's an apples and oranges comparison, but the median OS is quote unquote better than what we've seen so far, and that the objective response rate, which is like around 36%, is quote unquote better than what we've seen before. But I agree with you. I mean, you know, when you look at the treatment related adverse events, at the end of the day, you know, grade 3-4 on the Nivo IPI arm was about 41% of patients. And when you look specifically at immune mediated hepatitis, that was a little bit more pronounced than we have seen in other the other IO studies. And so a lot of that kind of underlying hepatobiliary disorders, as they classified it, makes me a little nervous. I mean, I think it was around 11% of patients who had grade 3-4 hepatobiliary issues. And that's not insignificant in our HCC patients, because coming back from that can sometimes be really difficult to help our patients kind of reverse that kind of liver disease, liver damage, if you will. So I think that real world applicability and using it in real situations will help us. I know that a lot of, you know, people who are not me, who are community oncologists and have been using Nivo IPI for years in other diseases, might be more comfortable with it. But I don't think we can underestimate the impact of cirrhosis and underlying liver disease on giving Nivo IPI. So I'm going to be a little bit, cautious, I think.
While talking about what the future looks like, Rachna, what do you think is on the horizon for the treatment of unresectable hepatocellular carcinoma in frontline?
First of all, there's a lot of really interesting add-on approaches, whether that be, you know, other immunotherapy modulators like anti-TIGIT and you know, what adding in a checkpoint plus TIGIT plus, you know, that sort of approach could be. There's obviously still interest, clearly, from, if you look at the CARES 310 and even some of the other data that came out at ESMO, a TKI and an IO combination. Like you mentioned, LEAP was disappointing, the Lenva-Pembro combination, and so was the Cabo-Atezo combination. But I think there's still people looking at some of these approaches. To me, the most interesting space is really the combination multimodality approach as well. So there's a lot of interest in understanding that things like liver-directed treatments like radioembolization, transarterial chemoembolization can help. And, you know, it's already being looked at, like with the EMERALD-1 study looking at intermediate stage. But even in the advanced setting, we know that the morbidity and mortality that comes from HCC is from the disease in the liver, right? And so is there a benefit even in advanced HCC to combine these multimodality approaches with now these IO approaches? I think there's a lot of interest in that. And then, of course, there's, you know, a lot of hope for the cell therapy approaches, CAR-Ts, and looking at specific potential targets, if you will, that are pervasive in hepatocytes. So I think there's a lot going on in the frontline space. And, you know, I jokingly say that it's now a good problem to have, that we have a wealth of options. And hopefully that allows for patients who don't qualify for one drug or one regimen to have another regimen option available to them.
You know, future certainly looks exciting. In the community, we need to make sure that we give access to our patients to these clinical trials that will potentially become new standard of care treatment in the near future. Rachna, just before we close, any final thoughts or key takeaways for our listeners treating unresectable HCC?
My key takeaway is I jokingly say that, like, 15 years ago when I started being a GI oncologist, there was no way I was willing to treat HCC because all we had was sorafenibs. And now it's just such a different space. I mean, people are living longer. They're living well while they're living longer. They're sometimes dying of other causes as opposed to their HCC. I mean, it's just such a great time to be involved and to watch this landscape change so rapidly and in such an impactful way. So, I mean, it's just, there's so much more coming.
Exciting times, and immunotherapy has truly been the treatment of choice here and continues to evolve with some combinations here. Thank you so much, Dr. Shroff, for sharing your thoughts with us today. For our listeners, let us go over a quick recap on today's discussion. And remember, this is the first of 4-part series of hepatocellular carcinoma. In today's discussion with Dr. Rachna Shroff from University of Arizona Cancer Center, we had a chance to focus on first-line treatment options in unresectable hepatocellular carcinoma, particularly our available options for IO and IO combinations, keeping patients' medical comorbidities and their underlying liver function status is so critical.
In first line, we have options of tyrosine kinase inhibitors or atezo-bev based off IMbrave 150 or durvalumab with tremelimumab based off Himalaya or STRIDE study. Each available option comes with its fair share of unique side effects, and recognizing this is equally important. Thank you for joining us. Make sure to check out our other discussions in this series over the next few months. We also look forward to seeing you in person at GI ASCO 2025. We are the Oncology Brothers.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to find out more, then please look for the Oncology Medical Conversation podcast under the account of Core2Ed Medical Education. Also, don't forget to rate this podcast, subscribe to our channel, and share it with your colleagues. Thank you for listening and see you next time. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Ed and developed by HCC Connect, a group of international experts working in the field of oncology. The views expressed are the personal opinions of the experts, and they do not necessarily represent the views of the experts' organizations or the rest of the HCC Connect group. For expert disclosures on any conflict of interest, please visit the Core2Ed website.